The following is an encore performance. You're listening to Tales from the South.
This is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
All about the judgment day, telling us how rock and roll never stay.
Everybody, and welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. I'm your host, Paula Morrell. How's everybody doing on this cold Arkansas night? To my left here, playing the blues for us tonight, and every show is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. And during dinner, we had our house band, the incredible Mockingbird Hillbilly Band. You can check out their website at mockingbirdhillbillyband.com. And back behind me here is our set by esteemed Arkansas artist B.L. Cox. These genuine screen doors with mixed media portraiture are from her Views of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. Tonight we have three great stories for you. All are true, and all are told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Ann Biddick remembers as a child climbing and as an adult falling. And then Sheila Kiever has an interesting encounter with a Mexican, Johnny Depp. But let's kick off tonight's show on a dark Texas road in 1970, where an attempted murder forever changes Mary Beck in The Shooter.
Halfway to Dallas, driving in a borrowed car, something, I can't say what exactly, told me to turn around and go home to a small house on the highway just north of Terrell, Texas. 19 years old and a cashier at Safeway grocery store, I was staying with my parents to save money. I didn't get to Dallas that night. The house was empty when I got home, so I sat in the kitchen, tired, bored, sipping on coffee and a menthol cigarette at a pink kitchen table held up by black metal legs. The kitchen was still new to me since it wasn't long since my parents' latest move. I liked the look of the dark green blown glass vase set with seashells that was the favorite of my mother's. Scattered around were my stepdad's metal and wood projects in various stages of perfection, the carved gun stock, leather straps and tack, and a clock in the midst of repair. I was soaking in the peaceful, quiet, kind of familiar and kind of different atmosphere and taking in how the cabinets were too shallow for plates and the stove wasn't shallow at all. Then the back door banged open so hard it slammed against the wall and a neighbor I'd met, 50-something-year-old Tom, stood there all bloodied and flushed. "Mary, call the police and an ambulance," said Tom, "and get me a cigarette. Somebody just tried to kill me." Tom was a Camel's man. "You'll have to smoke menthol," I said. There was no 911 in those days, just a frantic call from me to the operator, dial O, and my tumbled directions for her to give to the ambulance and sheriff. Come to the White House, past the White House, past the Pink House, past the Red House, next to the cemetery on the north side of town, I said, or something like that. It was enough, I guess. Since I didn't know the address, it's all I had. Tom was pacing and dripping blood all over the place. He had a bullet bulging out the side of his neck. And skin between his thumb and forefinger was torn and ragged. He said he thought he'd been shot in the chest. I told him to lie down on the old couch the dog slept on. I tore the front of his t-shirt open, and I didn't see any bullet holes, so I told him he was okay. At the time, I didn't know that a bullet through a nipple really didn't show up. What happened, I asked, as if nothing did. I walked into my house carrying some groceries and someone come out of my bedroom and shot me, Tom said. I pictured old Tom with two paper grocery sacks and a surprised look. Tom said he didn't know the shooter. He said he pulled out his own gun and tried to shoot back, but his gun misfired, so he ran down to our house. He had to climb a couple of fences at the pig lady's house. He said he thought the man followed him because he heard him going over the fences behind him, but he didn't stop to look. The baying of the hounds behind our house and the neighing of horses made me think he was right about being followed. Sirens blared and Sheriff Modine Sanders and an ambulance pulled up outside. I had convinced Tom that he didn't get shot in the chest and that the groceries probably stopped the bullet, that he just felt an impact. But when the paramedics picked him up, the rest of his t-shirt fell off and there was a hole in his back. Modine got a statement from Tom and then left me there, just north of town, with the dogs and horses still tracking the gunman. As he drove off, he said he wasn't going to look for the man alone. When Tom was loaded into the ambulance, he told me to get a gun and shoot anything that moved. It became quiet, too quiet. I focused on the floor that had to be cleaned up before my mom and Becky and Ron got home. So I took towels and swabbed the floor, rinsed them in a tub full of water, and did that several times till you couldn't even tell somebody had been bleeding all over the place. The drain gurgled when I pulled the plug, and I watched the tub of blood disappear. It was really, really red. It was kind of hectic when I finally got in touch with my mom. She drove home from a friend Shirley's house, and we tumbled steps back and forth from the house to the car, loaded down with arms full of Civil War guns, and locked the keys in the house. The unhunted man may have run off by then, perhaps scared by the sirens and animals, or maybe he saw us with all those guns. Later, I learned someone had ordered a hit on Tom, who, by the way, had invented the change maker on a Coca-Cola machine. That's all that happened. I don't know why, really, that I turned around from that trip to Dallas that night. You might say I have good instincts. Or maybe, just maybe, someone was looking out for Tom that night.
Mary Beck is a writer and artist when she isn't working in local government. Writing is her passion, and she has dozens of articles published. She is awaiting publication of her first book.
You're listening to Tales from the South, and we're going to get right back to our stories here in just a bit, but I'm backstage at the Starving Artist Cafe along with Paula Morrell, and we want to pass this word along to you while we have this break. We want to hear your story. What do I mean by that? We're open for submissions. We're looking for new writers and new stories to come alongside and be presented here on this form called Tales from the South. Paula, why don't you give us a basic rundown of the guidelines for submission?
The stories must be true, and they must be told by the person who lived them. They can be set anywhere in the world and in any time period. The connection to the South is the writer. So the writer must be either from the South originally or living here now. And all of our submission guidelines and how to submit are on our website, which is www.talesfromthesouth.com.
That's great. And by the way, for those folks who haven't had a lot of experience of writing personal narrative or presentation like this, please, if you've got a great story to tell, go ahead and get in touch with us. That's part of what Paula does, is help people to tell their own story. So get in touch with us. Again, the website address, the best way to get in touch with us would be through the website, talesfromthesouth.com. Let's get back to our stories now, and here again is Paula.
In our next story, Ann Biddick remembers climbing a tree and how to reach for the light in On a Limb.
As the sun slides down behind the growing clouds of night, I climb up the stairs to my bedroom. on the top floor of the house I inherited, which stands in the little village of historic Washington, not far from where I was born. I sit on the edge of my bed and look out at the last streams of yellow fade in the sky. I stare at the place where a favorite apple tree once lived. Now, like my life, the place where the tree stood is empty, and loneliness lives in my room. I think of my childhood when I spent a large part of time sitting happily on a limb of a beloved hickory tree in the front yard of a house in McCaskill, another Arkansas village. That tree had a limb which bent out over the grass of the lawn as it met the black-topped road in front of the house. I don't recall the struggle of learning to climb. It seems I was just suddenly up there. When people walked into town and under my perch, I thought they didn't know I was up there. Old John would walk along slowly, kicking rocks, spitting out blobs of chewing tobacco, and talking to himself, or so I thought. "Me and my hound dog need to catch something to eat," he would grunt as he scuffled along. "Ain't got no more taste for moon pies." Not knowing then what moon pies were, my imagination would bounce up into the rolling clouds as I searched for the silent outline of a moon, obscured by the southern sun's powerful glare. "I'm sure glad the world is flat," old Hamp would say to the wind as he waddled past my tree. "If it wouldn't, we'd all fall off." He'd then bend down, over laughing in a center stage performance, which he repeated again and again for the child sitting high up in the tree balcony. John and Hamp were well-known characters of that little village. Both loved to talk. Both wore baggy trousers and scuffy shirts for days and days before they let their wives scrub them on the old metal washboards. Neither of them seemed to want to be anywhere except in that little two-store town. Both spent most of their days hanging out at the old service station so they could see who went by and who stopped in and who had something to tell about. Both of these old men had wives and children and cows and chickens. One of them had a truck, and they had friends. Or they never thought that anyone was not a friend. They never seemed to know loneliness. Loneliness for an only child in a tiny village far from the developing world is a cloak, both heavy and light. I had no reason to try to calculate the heaviness of that isolation, as I had no scale which could show the measurement of sometimes, never, always. I had no way to compare always to never as I sat in my tree or played alone. The light of imagination and dramatic pretending was also immeasurable for me. No one asked me if I thought everyone had a vividly vibrating imagination. No one told me that most people in the world had other things to do rather than just to pretend. I also spent hours and hours in my little playhouse behind the real house. There I could speak and laugh and whisper and weep through all my play scenes. And, like the tree falling in the forest, be eternally unheard. My mind was highly stoked with images of birds, butterflies, sailing skies, howling wolves, and the music of my mother's voice. and the country voices of all the old Johns and old Hamps. Sitting alone in my tree and growing up as an only child did not help me to develop exceptional stages of conventional wisdom. My personal options were embossed with pieces of spirit inherited from my parents. Hear a story, be a storyteller. Watch the clouds, draw their faces. See the profiles of characters that live in a tree. Paint the lines and colors and images. And go far away to college to find the world. But I somehow remained disconnected, isolated, no matter where I was, always like a child high up in a tree. Through 18 years of what I thought was a wondrous marriage with three brilliant and beautiful daughters, I often saw my husband fly off to exotic spots to pronounce things in the banker's language. One night, when we lived in Providence, Rhode Island, I met his plane and I watched him come slowly down to earth. He picked up his luggage and walked out to the car without a hint of embrace. I deciphered for another uncountable time that his tight lip was evidence of an international businessman with preoccupation with the world beyond my reach. We drove into town to our favorite pub. As the first sip of my choice wine touched my lips, I saw that he held on to the edge of the table with both hands. And then I heard him say, "I'm getting a divorce. I'm moving to Boston. I've got a child on the way." As if he were speaking to some distant acquaintance. We drove home to forever sleep in separate bedrooms. I watched him leave the next morning with suitcase, raincoat, briefcase, and a pair of tennis shoes slung over one shoulder. Now I sit on the edge of my bed and watch the sun's last streaks of yellow welcome the approaching night outside the window of my inherited house. I look for tree shadows on the grass, but my apple tree is gone. The sky darkens. There's not the sound of anyone, anywhere, but the stories I'll write and the visions I'll paint. I'll paint them as they swoop down to me as the stars begin to gleam.
Ann Biddick lives in the historic village of Washington, Arkansas. She teaches art at Southern Arkansas University in Magnolia, and when she is at home, she paints, writes when the creative lights are on, and dances in the shadow of the moon. In our final story of the night, Sheila Keever travels to Mexico to be helped by a Jack Sparrow with less hair in The Dichos Authority.
We were sitting on the side of the road in Cancun, Mexico, my three sisters, all of us grandmothers, trying to laugh. I was on my way to research archaeological similarities between our local Indian culture and the Inca Maya Indians. How dull is that? My sisters were there to put a little fun into it. They have a tendency to laugh at everything, which is why they were invited. We zipped through customs and out the lobby, renting a car just large enough for the four of us, one bag and a bikini. We wish. We all laughed about that. We might scare the Mayan Indians out of their graves. Sí, señora, the airport valet nodded. I'm almost sure he was answering our conversation when he opened the door to our car and nodded us on our way to town about 20 minutes away. There's always seems to be a lot of head nodding in foreign countries. I was driving. There was some traffic, but not heavy. We were all laughing about the last conversation. I noticed a man walking along the highway, probably not an unusual occurrence, but the next moment, this man we were about to pass turned toward the car and threw something directly at us. It came right in our windshield as I was putting my foot on the brake and halfway ducking. It was a board or a brick, I'm not sure what. I swerved onto the shoulder and jerked to a stop, my vision totally blurred with a cracked windshield in front of me. We all jumped out of the car, shaking and speechless and not laughing. What happened? Cars driving behind us had also stopped. There were people jabbering in rapid Spanish. My sisters and I were totally blank as what to do next. We looked at each other to make sure we were okay. Then someone finally spoke in English and said, "That man ran that way," pointing to the south. Oh, Lordy, what do we do now? The bystander told us that the police would be here soon, or he could take one or two of us back to the airport. We could leave the damaged car here for the tow truck. The four of us decided to wait for the police, stay with our luggage, and deal with the car rental service later. He offered to notify the car rental service for us. We thanked him and waited at the side of the road. The tow truck arrived first. But this wasn't just any run-of-the-mill tow truck. At first, I thought it was a demolition derby contest winner. As it came closer, it looked more on the artistic side with a lot of colorful tonal effects. I decided it looked more like a faded cartoon billboard or a paint-by-number vehicle wrap. It definitely was a Spanish advertisement on wheels, although we could not decipher what it was advertising other than dents. A young man, actually not so young, all things being relative, got out of the cab with mariachi music blaring behind him. He was as eclectic as his truck. He kind of looked like Johnny Depp's older brother with a mustache, or more of a Captain Jack Sparrow with less hair, or maybe a little bit of a smiley Sweeney Todd. A little devious, comical, lackadaisical, serious, and possibly ingenious. He truly looked like he could step into any of Johnny Depp's characters on a whim. "You called?" he said in a Ricardo Montalban English. "No," we said, "we are waiting for the authorities." He replied with a devilish grin, "I'm the authorities." "You got to be joking." He was, of course, joking. "Oh, those authorities," he laughed. He told us that his radio catches the police dispatches, and he automatically goes to the scene of the accident. He said he could take us anywhere, or he would spend the day with us waiting to make sure that nothing else happened, and we would most likely tow the vehicle back to the rental car service. "Ah, sort of an ambulance chaser," I thought. "I'm at your disposal," he replied, seemingly apropos. This was comic relief as we looked at his truck. "Does this happen often? Will they go after the man who did it?" We badgered him with questions. "I wish I could say," he said as he appeared to be Willy Wonka on the Mexican underground. All sorts of scenarios popped into my head. "Are you the artist?" pointing to the truck, and realizing for the first time that the bed of the truck was actually a hearse, gutted with a winch protruding from its trunk. "One and the same," he replied with a wide grin. "I paint in my free time, which is all the time. I don't get paid much, but everyone knows me, and I never have to buy a meal. I just paint. I paint everything you want, cartoons, portraits, abstracts, landscapes, murals, bodies. I could paint your luggage, anything you want." I was enamored. "What are the words painted on the bumper?" "Ah, the dichos. From my heart it comes," he said flamboyantly. "Si me mueves, me sacas todo lo que tengo." In English? "If you move me, everything I have will fall out. Or if you get me going, you get everything I have." There it was, the whole proverb of the man and his truck, one of which volumes could be written. The police came. The car was replaced with another vehicle. Johnny Depp's twin, the Dichos Authority, handed us his card and said he would paint our portraits if we called him. I could imagine four gray Mona Lisas painted on a dull gray railroad boxcar in bright neon traveling across the country for all the world to see. Of course, we would be laughing.
Sheila Kiever is a stay-at-home mosaic artist who is working on a historical novel occurring during the Hernando de Soto's discoveries of the 16th century. She loves the eclectic look and Johnny Depp movies and her husband, not in that order. How about our stories and storytellers tonight? What'd you think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Support provided by Lehman Library, the Argenta Arts Foundation, and the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, visit talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of downtown North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations for Tales from the South provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhouseNLR.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by the UALR School of Mass Communication. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can all be found on our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for keeping the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.
Will the preacher said I only wanted to warning us all about the judgment day, telling us how rock and roll will never stay.